This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, a recent national poll of more than 1,500 people finds that close to half the respondents say that the choice of the next Supreme Court justice was very important to them. The survey conducted by the Marquette Law School also asked how people perceive the ideological breakdown of the nation's highest judicial body. Important to note, the poll completed before the death of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on Friday. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Where do you stand on appointments to the Supreme Court? This one in particular, how should the Senate handle this next appointment? Is the Supreme Court a voting issue for you? Does it sway your vote for Senate, which we're not doing in Wisconsin this year, or for president, which we are? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Charles Franklin is director of the Marquette University Law School poll. Charles, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you, Rob.
Well, you're off your usual turf here. People may think Marquette poll and think it's a Wisconsin thing. You went nationwide with this one, right?
That's right. We also did this a year ago, and it's becoming an annual event, a national survey of opinion about the Supreme Court. And as you mentioned, this was completed before Justice Ginsburg's death. So, of course, the ramping up of the confirmation battle is all something that's come after we were interviewing people.
Well, let's look at the results. What did people say when you asked them, hey, is this a big deal to you, the Supreme Court justice appointments in general?
Well, first of all, overall, 48% said the next appointment was very important to them. Another 34 said somewhat important, and 17% not at all important. Undoubtedly, now that there is a vacancy, the importance levels will go up. But I think the 48% is a pretty good indication that while a lot of people feel very intensely about the court, there's almost an equal number that are not as engaged in the court. And I think that is a fundamental gap between the arguments we will hear about this confirmation. And it's important to know that for a lot of people, the court is a distant institution, not one that they wake up every morning thinking about.
Is there any kind of indication among the people you talk to of who is caring more, whether it's partisan breakdown or the intensity of their support for one party, how closely they follow politics or supporters on one or other side of big issues?
We do see a little bit of difference there. First of all, by vote of the Biden supporters, likely voters, 59% say the appointment is very important to them. With Trump voters, it's 51%. That's not a big difference, but it's slightly more with the Biden folks than the Trump folks. When we look at it by partisanship, 56% of Democrats say very important, 48% of Republicans, and independents a good deal lower at 39%. So there is some partisan gradation and a somewhat smaller difference in the Trump versus Biden voters.
It's interesting because I think at least sometimes in political discussion, there's a sense that Republicans in general do a better job of mobilizing voters based on the Supreme Court issue. Even though, at least in this survey, it sounds like Democrats were, as you said, a little bit more interested, but more interested.
Yeah, I think that holds up. There are some exceptions, and let's note those. For people that would very strongly favor striking down Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion, 59% of those folks rank the court as very important. But of those who are strongly opposed to striking down Roe, 56% rank it as very important. The groups that are lukewarm about Roe are much less concerned about the court. Also, if we look at the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, which is on the Supreme Court docket for this fall to consider striking down the ACA or not, among those who strongly would like to knock down ACA, 53% rank the court as very important. But of those strongly opposed to striking down Obamacare, 61% rank the court as very important. So what you see is it's not all completely lopsided importance in terms of how different sides of issues or different sides of party rate the importance of the court seat.
Looking at all the data, did you try to assess whether the Supreme Court justice appointments in and of themselves are something that people are thinking about when they decide who to vote for?
Well, there are some differences, but what we see is a lot of alignment, between people's partisanship and their views of the issues before the court. So unsurprisingly, if we look by issues, people who would like to strike down Roe versus Wade are much more for Donald Trump. Those who would like to preserve Roe versus Wade, much more for Joe Biden.
We're talking to Charles Franklin right now, director of the Marquette University Law School poll, with us to talk about national opinions on Supreme Court justice nominees. In light of the recent death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the survey happened before that. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about this polling? Where do you stand on how Supreme Court nominations should be handled? What would you like to see change, if anything, when it comes to the Supreme Court? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about public opinion surrounding nominations to the U.S. Supreme Court. Charles Franklin is with us, director of the Marquette University Law School poll. This is a national poll. We're talking about a survey that he did. It had ended just before the passing of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Now, Charles, we talked some about attitudes toward the Supreme Court, whether it's important to people, whether people vote on it. You also asked people about questions related to the timing of court appointments and the approval process in the Senate. Obviously, a big issue now, just a month and a half before Election Day. Big issue back in 2016, the process that was frozen 8 months before Election Day. What kind of things did you hear from people about whether people should hold off on these approvals?
Sure. So the first thing is that most people, over 60%, whether Republican, Independent, or Democrat, said that if there was a vacancy, hearings should be held for the nominee during this fall. Now, again, that's before the seat opened, and no doubt people are changing their views, or party leadership is leading people to see this differently. But I think the reason for that is that substantial majorities thought that blocking hearings on Merrick Garland in 2016 was the wrong thing to do. And among Democrats, that's a whopping 84% who say it was wrong to block him. And for independents, 78%. Even among Republicans, a small majority, 54%, say that blocking Garland was wrong. Now we turn the tables and the question is, hold hearings now. And people who thought, well, they deserve a hearing, still believe they deserve a hearing. Notice holding a hearing is not the same as confirm the justice as well. But this also goes to that point that for a lot of people, simple common sense applies to these issues. And so there's a vacancy, go ahead and hold hearings. A lot of people say that. It's when the political battle is joined and the leadership on each side is explaining to voters why Democrats don't think a hearing should be held now. That's when opinion starts to change, just as Republican leadership in 2016 had to explain to Republican voters why common sense, hold a hearing, didn't apply and why their blocking of a hearing mattered then. Again, this is where leadership matters so much, because most people don't strategize and worry about the process the way people deeply involved in the court and the battles over it worry about these issues every single day.
People say they would have preferred a hearing in 2016. Is there any sign at all, though, that there was a punishment for not doing what you said in that case was common sense, holding a hearing, and whether it's 2016 or 2020?
I think there was disapproval of it then, but in terms of consequences, in terms of translating these kinds of inside Washington, even though terribly important, processes into votes for U.S. Senate or for president, There you're seeing some slippage, in part because the court is not salient to everyone, and because there's a tremendous range of other things that matter to us a lot right now, including COVID and the economy and Black Lives Matter. And this is one of that mix.
Anything surprising in the Supreme Court part of this new survey to you?
I think the things I would stress go to this issue of how we don't share universal views of the court. And these are important as we go through the confirmation process, because a lot of people genuinely don't appreciate some facts. So right now, five of the nine justices were appointed by Republican presidents. Without Ginsburg, that leaves it as three. But one in three Republicans continue to believe there's a Democratic majority on the court. One in four independents believe that. And even one in five Democrats believe that there are more Democrats on the court than Republicans. Another point is, if you listen to the intense partisan debate, you would see a court that is extremely conservative, or there's a threat to make it more liberal. In point of fact, half, 54%, see the court as moderate in its ideology, and another 30% see it as conservative, but only 5% see the court as very conservative, and 11% see it as liberal or very liberal. So that's another example of a real mismatch between the way the public sees the court and the politics of the court, and the way those people who are involved in the intense battles over appointments see the court, and in the way they portray that court to the public. For a lot of people that are listening to these court fights, it paints a picture of the court that they simply don't perceive in their normal day-to-day lives.
You'll be releasing more court-related surveys. Just wanted to ask briefly, you also looked at the presidential race. What did you see there when it came to Biden versus Trump and to the president's approval ratings?
Absolutely. Here we see a solid Biden lead. This is, remember, nationally.
National.
Among likely voters, 50% for Biden, 40% for Trump. Jorgensen at 3 and Hawkins, the Green candidate, at 2, 5% undecided. And running down approval of President Trump on the economy, 51 approve, 49 disapprove. On his appointments to the court, past appointments to the court, 47 approve, 52 disapprove. Overall, a little bit lower, 41, 58. On handling the coronavirus, 38, 62. And handling the Black Lives Matter protests, 37, 62. Those ratings are a little bit lower on the national scale than what we're seeing in Wisconsin, where we have his overall job at approval at 44-54 in our poll early this month.
Charles, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you, Rob.
Charles Franklin is director of the Marquette University Law School poll. He joined us today to talk about a recent national poll looking at public opinion on Supreme Court justice nominations. Coming up after the news, when it comes to infrastructure, the roads, transit, energy, drinking water, and more, a new report says Wisconsin, kind of mediocre. We'll take a look at what it says and how we could improve that grade. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new report shows that when it comes to infrastructure, Wisconsin has some work to do. The Wisconsin section of the American Society of Civil Engineers gives the state an overall grade of C, which is considered mediocre. The report looked at 13 categories, including roads, transit, aviation, ports, drinking water, solid waste, and more. Wisconsin's highest grade was a B for energy, but there are D pluses on the downside for roads and transit. The report says a lot of Wisconsin's infrastructure requires capacity or maintenance upgrades or is reaching the end of its expected lifespan. Jennifer Schaff is Technical Resource Engineer for County Materials Corporation in Roberts in western Wisconsin and President-elect for the Wisconsin section of the American Society of Civil Engineers. She's also co-chair of the 2020 report card for Wisconsin's infrastructure. Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob, for having me. Happy to be here.
It's a mixed bag. We'll look at some of the details. Are you surprised by this report, especially the downsides of it?
No, I don't. I don't currently practice in all of the categories, so my day-to-day is varied, but no, I think overall not surprised.
Well, let's start with where we got some of the lower grades in the road department, a long-running debate in Wisconsin over how we build roads, maintain roads, and maybe more importantly, pay for all of it. What were some of the things on this report card that ended up giving us this D+?
So I don't know if you were able to tune in to our release last week, but one of the items of note was this $13 billion shortfall over the next decade if roadway improvements aren't accounted for. And there's lots of good statistical information in the actual report. Deficient roads cost drivers $6 billion annually due to wear and tear on their vehicles, wasted fuel due to congestion and costs of crashes on roadways. But one of the things I found really compelling, Rob, and I'll read it to you here so I don't mince words. Roadway features are likely a contributing factor in approximately one-third of fatal traffic crashes. This is tremendously significant to drivers on rural roads in Wisconsin, where the state fatality rate doubles the national average.
How do we get here? This is something that didn't happen overnight. Talk about the years-long process that led to what you're saying is a pretty big deficiency here.
Sure. So, Rob, much of our roadways were designed for a 1950s-style vehicle, not the vehicles we drive today. So we need geometric changes. We need to create sufficient clear zones and update traffic operations to make roadways safer. Due to lack of funds, you know, everyone's trying to do more with less. Wisconsin DOT has had to resort to resurfacing non-interstate roadways just to make them usable. And for lack of a better term, this is really a facelift. It doesn't address those roadway features I mentioned previously. And note too, Rob, that the DOT has jurisdiction over approximately 12% of roadways. The remainder are under local control, and resurfacing there appears to be a trend as of late.
That's roads. Let's turn to our other low one. We'll get to the happier news later. Transit. So this is getting around in ways other than hopping in our own personal cars. Where do you see us falling short in this report on transit issues?
Transit is really a funding issue. So, you know, let me give you a couple highlights here, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure.
Wisconsin relies on state and federal funding for capital needs, but, you know, federal funding has had serious reductions, and it's really jeopardizing the reliability of the network. Most funding at the state level comes from local property taxes, and those have really proven inadequate for meeting current needs. And this leads to less service, reduced hours of operation. And so here's a telling statistic. Total transit trips decreased by 17.3% in Milwaukee and Madison. And this is compared to a reduction of only 10% on other national medium and small systems, which are similar. And these numbers I'm giving you are before COVID. So, you know, people are not seeing these systems as reliable.
People might think of transit and picture, you know, a subway in a really big city or fixed line bus routes in medium to larger cities. In the report, you also mention that this is an issue for rural areas. It might not look like it does in a city, but transit issues are there too.
Correct. Correct. And so as a state, we need to decide if transit is going to be a reliable option for folks. And really, you know, it's an access point for jobs, a way for people to get to jobs.
We're talking to Jennifer Schaff with the American Society of Civil Engineers Wisconsin section, president-elect there, looking at a new report from the society, a report card on Wisconsin's infrastructure from roads to transit to energy to ports and beyond. Let's get to a happier grade. How did we do on energy infrastructure?
Energy, I'm so glad you asked. Energy, we did really well on you know, energy, we have natural gas, nuclear, and coal sources that are going to ensure Wisconsin's energy needs through 2024. a couple highlights. Wisconsin's 10.58 cents per kilowatt hour rate provides reliable funding for generation, transmission, and distribution infrastructure. And some might point to that rate as being higher than the Midwest and national average. But Wisconsinites are savvy, and they tend to have lower monthly bill averages. Another bright spot is Wisconsin's Focus on Energy program. A lot of people have probably heard of this, but they may not realize it's funded by utilities. And it's been found to achieve about a $4.32 benefit for every dollar in costs. Another high point is they showed a net economic benefit of $348 million in 2016. And then one more last point is Governor Evers has set a net zero greenhouse gas emission goal by 2050, which is really an aggressive goal.
Then we've got drinking water, which has been in the news in different parts of the state for different reasons. It might be lead water lines in Milwaukee. It might be concerns about a runoff in parts of northeastern and southwestern Wisconsin. When the report card looked at drinking water around the state as a whole, what kind of things did you find?
So just a little bit of background. Wisconsin has more than 11,000 public water systems. And that's amongst the most in the nation. About 5% of them service more than 4 million residents, which is impressive. We're looking at $8.6 billion will be needed to address these systems over the next 20 years. And a couple highlights. In 2018, utilities produced about 186 billion gallons of water, but they lost over 26 billion gallons to water leakages. And I looked back through the report, and it looks to me like about 33% of those mains are circa 1940 or older. So, you know, we need infrastructure to improve and replace some of those water lines. Utilities are also lacking in risk-based pipeline prioritization and asset management programs, and those could help lower costs and reduce overall water usage and also help us to look at cost-effective alternatives to main replacements.
You looked at a lot of other issues, but I want to talk a little bit about priorities. One issue you looked at was dams. I happened to be on Lake Delton not too long ago, which had in recent memory a dramatic dam failure led to big costs. When you look at these infrastructure issues in any of these categories, how do you weigh, you know, the cost of doing maintenance now versus maybe a growing risk of a catastrophic thing that's going to cost us a lot down the road?
So, Rob, maybe reword your question for me a little bit.
Can you talk about the benefits of, I guess, spending on maintenance and prevention now versus risks of bigger damage later?
Oh, for sure. For sure. You know, the longer we wait to do corrective measures, the more expensive they tend to get. So the more, you know, for lack of a better term, Band-Aids we put on things, the likelihood of the cost increasing goes up significantly. And it also creates a lot of risk in our system. I think we always want to be on the side of caution, particularly when our systems are in an older condition, and want to be diligently monitoring them.
We'll leave it there. Jennifer, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure, Rob.
Jennifer Schaff is Technical Resource Engineer for County Materials Corporation in Roberts in western Wisconsin and now President-elect for the Wisconsin section of the American Society of Civil Engineers. We talked to her about the group's 2020 report card for Wisconsin infrastructure, gave Wisconsin an overall grade of C.